Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. Syracuse City Mayor Ben Walsh recently delivered his third State of the City message, so it's a good time to look back and also to look forward. The mayor was elected as an independent in 2017, putting together a diverse coalition of supporters and winning a majority of votes in a multi-candidate field. Mayor Walsh, welcome back to the program.
Great to be back, Grant.
So let's just start with the beginning and get you to reflect on that, and then we'll move forward from there. But when you originally ran, you ran on a platform that you called Syracuse Rising, and it concerned the quality of life and safety in the city, educational excellence, and the reduction of poverty. So I wanted to get your sense of, in terms of those goals, what do you think you've been able to make the most progress on so far?
Well, it's amazing, first off, how fast 2 years goes. I have had a blast in this job. It's a really tough job, but I'm thrilled to have a great team around me. And I think we've made a lot of progress. I pride myself on being a data-driven decision maker. We measure data every day and hold ourselves accountable to it. And when you look at the things that I campaigned on and then you measure how we've performed, by most metrics, we've made progress. Not enough by my standards and probably many others, but look at things, you know, the numbers that for so long have defined our decline as a region. Population between 2017 and 2018 actually inched up. We were the only big city in New York State where that happened. Vacant properties went down about 12% just in my first year in office, and over 5 years, about over 20%. Jobs. We are outperforming all of our upstate counterparts in job growth, private sector job growth. Again, we want to, of course, compare ourselves beyond just upstate New York, but for a long time we lagged behind our upstate counterparts. So, again, when we look at the numbers, when we look at the data, we see progress, and we want that to continue.
You know, I was going to talk about this later, but you mentioned a couple of things there that make me want to put it in right now. I'm sure that this report caught your eye. There was a recent report done by a think tank that looked at the divide between some of the big cities that have a lot of younger tech savvy and tech educated folks in it, and the way that they're growing as opposed to the rest of the country. And they identified a bunch of other sort of smaller cities that they thought were ripe for that. And Syracuse was in that list.
Yeah.
Say a bit about what you made of that and how that fits in with some of the things that you just said.
Yeah, I think it confirms what certainly I've believed and what many of us have believed here, that we're poised for growth in this city. You look at some of the bigger cities, and while they have seen a lot of investment and a lot of progress, they've also seen the challenges that come along with that, ensuring quality, affordable housing for people. And so there are a lot of individuals that value the urban experience that are being priced out of large metropolitan areas and are increasingly looking at mid-sized cities like Syracuse, where they can still benefit from those urban amenities but have a better quality of life. And so, again, we feel like we're poised for that. And again, looking at some of our other data, it supports that we are that we're already making progress towards that end. You mentioned young people. So millennials, I think people found it very surprising that we had the third highest growth rate of millennials of any city in the country. Even poverty, you mentioned our poverty rate, and that for a long time has been, you know, something that is that has really jumped out and defined us in not the right way. But our poverty rate, while still way too high, actually went down about 2% year over year. So we went down from about 32.5% to a little over 30% over the past year. So those metrics, combined with some of those larger macro economic forces that are impacting municipal or urban areas, I think bode well for us. But we need to continue the progress, and we need to control the things that we can control for it to continue.
You mentioned data a couple times and being data driven, and I wanted to ask you a question about that, because again, you in your campaign, you really emphasized this notion of performance management and government and using data and innovation to get a better handle on that. Could you say a bit more about how you've done that in your administration so far?
Yeah, so again, my first priority in taking office was to get the right team together, and I think largely we've done that. And we've added some really great components and additions to the team since the first year. But also a top priority that we implemented was establishing a performance management system where we could actually, again, establish a baseline of information that we could then measure our progress by. And so that came in the form of this performance management dashboard where we adopted a model called the acronym is OKR, Objectives and Key Results. It's a strategic management or performance management process used, popularized in Silicon Valley by private sector tech companies locally. Hmm. A company like TCG Player uses it. And essentially you identify a number of objectives and then key results that help you measure your progress for each of those objectives. So for us, it's generally speaking, fiscal sustainability, delivering services efficiently, effectively, and equitably, strengthening our neighborhoods and economic opportunity, and also delivering quality constituent engagement and response. So for each of those four metrics, we have specific key results that we measure. That dashboard is public, so anybody can get on our website, which we're going to be actually upgrading finally this year, but they can go on that dashboard and see how we're doing from everything from, you know, how many likes we're getting on Facebook to how many potholes we're filling. And while there's a certain vulnerability in putting that all out there, that's, you know, we remind ourselves we're here to serve the public. And so, we should be measuring our progress using the same baseline of information that our constituents are, and we are, and it's working.
What's the easiest way for our listeners to get a look at that dashboard? Would it just be to Google City of Syracuse and go in the main page?
Yeah, the main page, which again is hasn't been updated in over a decade and will be updated this year, brand new site. www.syrgov.net, and then on the right-hand side, you'll see a button for the performance management dashboard. Okay. You can click on that, and you can really dig down deep if you're interested in that kind of stuff. And you'll see some things that I think you'll be really impressed by, like we increased the number of streets we paved last year by 67%. But you also see things that we still need a lot of work in.
I'm Grant Reher. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm speaking with Syracuse City Mayor Ben Walsh. This one's kind of out of left field, but you mentioned the website needing an update and not having been updated. I haven't done any research on this, so I am speaking based on a rumor here. But is the city logo is being redesigned? Is that do I hear that right? Or
so Councillor Mike Green, who's one of our at-large councillors, a sharp young guy who's been a good partner for us. He chairs our DPW committee, is really passionate about both generally the city logo, but specifically the city flag. And he came upon this TED Talk about city flags and the messages they send to stakeholders. And, if you look at our city flag, it's pretty basic. It includes our original city seal, which has smokestacks in it and doesn't necessarily reflect the Syracuse that is today.
It's kind of hard to figure out what it is, too, when you look at it, at least to me.
Yes.
Yeah, so, what am I looking at here?
Right. So. Again, Councillor Green is forward thinking and saw it as an opportunity to change the face of our city in the form of our flag, and that's a process that he has started. And like everything else, you have to prioritize as you see fit. But it's something that when he first pitched it to me, I said, oh, that sounds like fun. Let's if you're willing to take the lead on it, we're willing to work with you. And so, one of many things we have going on.
Might be a great opportunity to get the public involved in it and have voting on it. And
absolutely,
all that kind of
that's a constituent engagement is a big part of that process. Yeah,
great. Now I want to flip things around and talk about sort of the negative for a minute. You when you came in, you had a lot of experience already in and around city government. I wanted to know, even though you had that experience, what areas, topic areas or problem areas have surprised you the most in terms of their resistance to, for lack of a better word, their treatment resistance or their resistance to intervention? Where have you felt like you've come up against the thickest walls and trying to move something?
Well, a few things come to mind. I think in terms of all of the challenges that we face in city government and as a community, there are some ones that are fairly intractable or feel that way at times that as a mayor and as a government are really hard to move the needle on. So when you look at things like poverty, as much as we're pleased that the needle has moved, it's hard to impact that. The issue of violence in our community, which is certainly not unique to the city of Syracuse, is one that is extremely difficult, and for me personally, has been hard for me to figure out the most effective way for me to engage on that issue. Whether it's showing up on the scene of a homicide, showing up at the hospital to meet with a family that's been impacted by it. Personally, that's been really hard for me to deal with. I think, in addition to just kind of the human factor of it all, the fact that as I consider myself a problem solver, somebody that comes in, that identifies the problem, brings the right people together to solve it. And problems like those are not conducive to that, that simple of a fix. And so I've struggled at times with trying to figure out, again, what the right role is to play there. I think more internally to city government, I was having a conversation yesterday and joking about the fact that in my previous role at City Hall as an appointee, and while I haven't been, no one has called me the same name as mayor. I suspect they do, not to my face, but there are certain people that are referred to as short timers in government, right? So I'm elected. I have a 4-year term. I hope to have another 4-year term on top of that. But whether you're elected or you're an appointee, there are individuals in government, and it's not unique to city government, that look at us as the short timers, and so. Whether it's because you're in civil service or you're a lifetime public servant, oftentimes it's those short timers that come in and try to make changes and try to move things around. And sometimes that's met with openness, and sometimes it's met with resistance. And candidly, there has been times when it's been met by resistance, and not because people are bad or because they don't want what's good for the city. It's just simply that they have to account for changes in individuals and management styles. And so it's been a challenge for me over the first 2 years, where I feel this great sense of urgency to change things as quickly as possible to maximize this limited opportunity that I have. I have to take into consideration the perspectives of others that are going to, that are in this is the middle of their, 20, 30, 40 mm-hmm. year career. And how can I make sure that I'm changing things in a way that takes into consideration how they feel and what their priorities are and what happens after I leave?
And that's probably important for having the changes be successful. You mentioned something there in passing. I have to pull out. I'd be remiss if I didn't. But you said you hope to have another four years. So you are planning for running for re-election at this point?
I would imagine there's some sort of formal announcement that traditionally takes place. But I have every intention of running again. I like I said, I love this job. It's the only job in public service that is of any interest to me right now. And I just I'm knowing how much we've accomplished in 2 years, but also how much more we have to do, I can't imagine having anything less than 8 years to get where I want the city to get to.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with City of Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh. Wanted to get a sense of how your working relationship with the city council has been. I mean, reading the news reports, it seems to, there's some tensions, sometimes not so much. So yeah. Tell me how it's been on your end.
I feel really good about it. We've, again, accomplished a lot over the past 2 years, and I tried very hard. I always try hard, but especially in this year's State of the City, to make sure that people understand that there's a lot of individuals, not the least of which are the councilors, that that have contributed to the success and that I couldn't do it without them. So you think about some of our signature initiatives, borrowing over $30 million to acquire our streetlight network and convert it to LED technology. If the councilors weren't willing to take what I think a lot of people would consider a significant risk to authorize that bond issuance, we wouldn't be there. And so, it's funny. There was an article written about the honeymoon being over 2 years in. Ironically, I wrote on a...
That's a pretty long honeymoon.
Well,
for
I think.
Official.
Well, I was going to say, ironically, but I think
it used to be a year. Now it's about 3 days.
I was about 2 months in when I wrote the honeymoon is over on a whiteboard in my office when we were dealing with whatever the drama was at the time, and that wasn't specific to the Common Council. But I think again, as I look at it, I can pick up the phone right now and call any one of the counselors, both the ones that have continued on and the new ones, and have a sincere conversation with them. And I have reoccurring meetings with all of the counselors. And again, this is a democracy. There should be a healthy tension between the executive and the legislative branch. And I joke with the counselors that they have the benefit of the fact that my dad is a lifetime legislator. And so every time I get a little too big for my executive britches, he reminds me of, you know, of the importance and the role of the legislative branch and checking me. And they do that. And more often than not, it leads to a positive outcome. So I'm not at all concerned about the relationship. I actually feel really good about it. And, you know, as we get towards, the end of my term, I'm sure it will continue to twist and turn as politics and other things intervene. But I'm confident that, you know, I campaigned on my ability to maintain and nurture relationships, and 2 years in, I feel like I've done that.
So let's talk a little bit about your recent State of the City address and some of the things that you set forward there. One in particular that caught my eye was something you were calling the Resurgent Neighborhood Initiative. And my understanding of it is the following, that you've already been doing some previous research. You've now identified 10 business corridors that you want to target for more public investment. And the hope is that these 10 corridors are ripe for more potential business development, and the public investments are going to make that business development more attractive. Did I get that right, basically?
That's a big part of it. That's okay. Pretty good. It's really tying a few related initiatives together. So it all falls under the umbrella of the Syracuse Surge, which is our strategy for inclusive growth in the new economy, which has largely been focused on kind of economic opportunity. And, you know, I'll be happy to talk about that. But an area where we wanted to focus more on was our neighborhoods and our neighborhood business corridors. And we had, again, a number of related initiatives. We've undertaken a study of all of our primary neighborhood business corridors, looking at real estate, looking at market opportunities, and trying to figure out how we can make some investments there and catalyze some development. We've also spent a lot of time, again, getting back to that data-driven process of looking at our neighborhoods, and particularly our neighborhoods that are maybe destabilizing, that are maybe have been on a downward trajectory, but looking at opportunities where we combined a number of different data sets from, you know, availability of vacant land that's either publicly owned or owned by the land bank, looking at proximity to those business corridors, proximity to public transportation, to schools and other community anchors, and prioritizing sites where we could actually do some strategic infill housing development, which is something that this city hasn't seen in decades. And in doing so, create new affordable housing opportunities before we end up in a crisis that other communities have seen. So it's tying all that together. With community engagement, we spent this past year having these kitchen table talks in mm-hmm. neighborhoods all over the city mm-hmm. to match what we're doing with the data and to vet that with the community to make sure that we're getting the priorities right. And all of that comes together under the umbrella of the Resurgent Neighborhoods Initiative. But again, we're looking to construct 50 new single-family homes in the city, another 75 two-family homes, and really start to change the trajectory of a lot of these neighborhoods and tie that into the growth of the surrounding business corridors.
Is there a approximate price tag, total cost to the city for this?
Well, it's there's a cost specifically to the residential development, and we're in the process of putting together our capital stack for that investment. The good news is that a lot of it will be through private mortgage financing, and that's why our housing partner home headquarters is such an important component of the plan. The council is hopefully on Monday will be authorizing a grant request to the state for another $2 million that will subsidize the some of that affordable housing development, and we need to plug in a few more pieces, but the good news is, again, most of it is private financing. So we're putting that together, but our goal is to start that construction on those homes this year and carry it on over the next 2 years.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh. So that approach does identify certain areas. So mm-hmm. you've made that identification. Now, more generally, when you in those terms, there will be, I think, critics who will say, "Well, you're picking winners and losers here. You're trying to do that, and that's not what the state should be doing." That's a frequent mm-hmm. critique of economic development efforts in the state of New York, but also around the country. So, how do you respond to that concern as it relates to this?
Well, first and foremost, it's a data-driven approach. So we're not reacting based on, you know, what's the most politically favorable or which neighborhood or community-based organization is yelling the loudest. We're using data to ensure that we are investing our limited resources where they can have the most positive impact. But we're combining that with the community engagement to make sure that we're also aligned with the priorities of the neighborhood. I think most people understand that we can't, with our limited resources, we can't invest everywhere at the same time. But I think by shining some light on the decision-making process that is leading us to make investments in certain places, our hope is that it gives our constituents peace of mind that there is a method, and that depending on how those investments go and depending on how certain factors change, that ultimately everyone will benefit from this strategic approach. And eventually, if your neighborhood isn't on the priority list now, it will be if we continue down this path. So, I understand that, and I know, like everybody else, when somebody puts a map in front of me with proposed investments, I always look, you know, where is it proximate to, you know, whether it's my house or other areas that are of interest to me. So that's a natural tendency for people. But again, I think that if we can help effectively communicate how it contributes to a more comprehensive plan, and that plan will be strategically implemented for years to come, even beyond my time in City Hall, then I'm hopeful that people will get on board with it.
So how will this initiative fit in with the redevelopment of the I-81 corridor?
Well,
that's a huge one.
It sure is, yeah. And it's the 81 process is continuing forward, and we're trying to do as much as we can while we're waiting for that process to be completed.
Where are we on the timeline of that, by the way? Sorry to interrupt, but just very specifically, where are we on this?
Yeah, I mean, the timeline admittedly has moved, and so sometimes it's hard to keep track, but we're told we have a great working relationship with New York State DOT, and our local DOT folks are doing a great job managing a very difficult, unwieldy process at times. But we're told that they released a preliminary draft environmental impact statement last year that identified the community grid as the preferred alternative. Mm-hmm. We're expecting a final draft environmental impact statement later this year, which then leads to an actual final environmental impact statement after that. So there's still steps in the process, but once we get to that, the final draft environmental impact statement, I think that will address any outstanding questions about the direction that the state is going. And then it's my hope that everyone will, folks that have not been bought into the community grid alternative will understand that that is the direction we're headed. And so they'll then be willing to come to the table to work with us to mitigate any concerns that they have and to move this project forward. So it's a long way of saying that, yeah, I don't have a specific time frame yet. Again, it's driven by the state. But I expect in 2020 we will, by the end of this year, we'll know where we're headed.
And we'll know what it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So go back to what you were saying before that. How does this neighborhood initiative fit in with that?
So it's tying all the pieces together and connecting the dots. When you look at our neighborhood business corridors, they're all extending out of our urban core, our downtown University Hill, our lakefront, where we're seeing a lot of investment happening. And we believe that based on how that investment will continue, combined with this transformational opportunity with 81, it's going to create a significant opportunity within the footprint of the 81 Viaduct, not only downtown, but to the south. And when you tie that with the really progressive, exciting work that the Syracuse Housing Authority is doing under the auspices of the Blueprint 15 mm-hmm. initiative, where they're essentially going to be creating a brand new mixed income, mixed use neighborhood where their existing properties are now, you can see how that is poised, if done right, to really lift up a significant geographic area of our city, and then again to tie it in through those arteries of our business corridors to the neighborhoods, and so it has a ripple effect. So it's one of many separate but related opportunities that we have in the city that, frankly, we haven't had in a generation.
We only have a couple minutes left for the broadcast portion of this. I'm hoping if you've got a bit of extra time, we might extend the conversation to an online kind of bonus section. But I wanted to turn now to the national political scene just real quickly, a minute or so. And I guess the gist of my question is there's a lot of partisan things going on at the national scene and at the state scene. Are you feeling like even more, even better about being an independent?
I've always been very comfortable in my own skin as it relates to being not affiliated with a political party. I think most people look at what's happening in Washington and you know, scratch my head and sometimes shake my head. Honestly, I don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about it or paying attention to it. We have so much to do here in Syracuse, and yeah, what happens in Washington impacts Syracuse. But my focus has been not to engage in the divisive, partisan debates. Simply to look at it through the lens of how does it impact the city of Syracuse. How do my relationships with our federal officials impact the city of Syracuse and act accordingly? So, for our two senators, Schumer and Gillibrand, in my limited interactions with them, we don't talk about impeachment or national politics. We talk about Syracuse and how they can help us. When I talk with Congressman Katko, same thing. When he brought Secretary Carson to town, we didn't have a debate about housing policy. We talked about the very serious issue that the city has with lead and how HUD can help us address that. And following up on that roundtable, the county was granted a significant lead grant from HUD that is really helping us address those on the ground issues. And I think if people spent more time thinking about how their actions at whatever level of government they're in impact those that they serve, maybe some of the divisiveness and the polarization would go away. But again, I don't have much time to worry about that. I just focus on my job.
There's one thing we didn't get a chance to talk about in the broadcast, and that is the city has a still relatively new police chief, Kenton Buckner. This was one of your big, decisions that you made early on, a long process in choosing him. So how are things going with him? How would you rate his performance so far?
I'm thrilled with the work that Chief Buckner has done. He's been here for a little over a year now. He certainly had his fair share of challenges. We talked earlier about, the difficulty of making change within, government and within trying to change culture in specific areas. And so he's run up against some challenges there. But again, over a year in my conversations with the rank and file, I think that, after the initial kind of concern of having somebody from, from the outside mm-hmm. come in, mm-hmm. they have a better feel for him. They have a better feel for me and what our priorities are. And he has accomplished a lot over the past year. He's completely changed the patrol strategy by dividing the city up into three different quadrants and ensuring that the officers that are on the streets are policing the same neighborhoods and engaging with the same individuals and really empowering police captains to be the primary points of contact for neighborhoods. He's introduced some really important policies that have long-ranging operational impacts on the department. Our use of force policy, certainly something that's been of interest to folks. We have a new body-worn camera policy. We have a new policy for how the police department engages with transgender individuals. We've continued to add new police classes as we've tried to contend with retirements. We just swore another class in, the third class of my administration, and it's one of the most diverse classes we've had in the history of SPD. We have countries represented within the department. We have Nigeria, somebody from Nigeria, from Sudan, from Mexico, from Germany. Mm-hmm. As I go back and look at the process that led up to the selection of Chief Buckner, the many community conversations we had, and I looked at what our priorities were, Chief Buckner has ticked all of them off the list, and I'm really happy with his performance.
So you mentioned the new classes of police officers. There's also been, I think, some new classes of firefighters as well.
Yeah.
So one question that comes out of that, obviously, is given that the previous administration didn't you know foregone those some of those new classes mm-hmm. for financial reasons. Mm-hmm. Can the city afford this? Because there's legacy costs that come in for this.
Of course, and I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think that was the case. And that also relates to the police contract, which has been something of significant debate in recent weeks. The reality is, first and foremost, public safety is a bedrock of any community. And as we try to change the trajectory and as we're seeing more investment in our city, in our neighborhoods, public safety is a critical component to that. And if people lose faith in our ability to keep them safe, the rest of it doesn't matter. And so for me, it isn't about creating a police state or doing anything other than just ensuring that every resident of the city of Syracuse, regardless of what neighborhood you live in, feels safe and feels like they have a police department that represents them and serves them effectively. From a financial perspective, you also have to look at what are the costs of not bringing on new officers. The primary one is overtime. And so mm-hmm. The expectation, and I've made it very clear with Chief Buckner, is that as we continue to try to build up the ranks, that as those numbers go up, the overtime numbers go down. And so, but it's an investment very much worth making. And as I remind my team all the time, our operating budget is a little over $250 million. That's a lot of money. I think for a long time we got used to this narrative that we're broke or that we're going broke, and that can be crippling for any organization. We have, again, over $250 million that we invest every year. It's about prioritizing where we make those investments and how we ultimately grow the size of the pie. I say all the time, we can't cut our way to prosperity. We have to figure out ways to grow. And ensuring a safe community, again, is a foundation for growth in my mind.
So a little more personal question about your experience as mayor so far. Is you're entering year three. Is there anything you wish you could have had a do-over on? Is there anything that, boy, I'd like to have another crack at that?
It's going to sound cliche, but I haven't had much time to think about it. Okay. There are certain things. I mentioned the police contract. We believe we negotiated a really good contract for our community, first and foremost, for the police department. The PBA, the police union, agreed with that and passed it, but the council to date has not. And so, I've spent a lot of time reflecting on how on the process that led to that agreement.
And their concern was too much money?
I think primarily financial concerns. Yeah. But again, I wouldn't do anything that I didn't think was in the best financial interest of the city. And, again, while we've all gotten used to that narrative that we're going broke, the reality is we have, nearly $50 million in our fund balance, which is about the same amount we had when I took office. And and increasingly over the first two budgets, we've decreased our budgeted reliance on the fund balance, and my intention is to continue that until we get to a balanced budget. But things like that don't quite go the way that we want, I spend a lot of time reflecting on and learning from, and I'll be the first one to admit, I learn every day. I've never done this job before. I think 2 years in, again, I feel that we've done a good job as a team, but there's a lot of room for growth for me personally and for everyone else at City Hall.
So a couple quick questions to finish. You just mentioned, things have been happening so fast, you don't have time to reflect back. But is there one best day as mayor so far that sticks out in your mind? My favorite day?
Not that immediately comes to mind.
Okay.
Again, the fact that I just did the State of the City does kind of force you to reflect. And as I looked back on everything that we accomplished over 2019, again, I mentioned Syracuse Surge, and you think about it from initially making that investment in streetlights. We had multinational corporations like JPMorgan Chase buy in and invest in that strategy, Microsoft buy in and invest in that strategy. More locally, a company like JMA Wireless bought a building on the south side of the city of Syracuse to manufacture high-tech 5G wireless equipment. A company like Bankers Healthcare Group acquired a new property at the Inner Harbor and is building a brand new headquarters. There's so many successes that we've had, and again, I can't think of just one in particular. But as I look at them collectively over the past 2 years, I do feel good about it. But I feel more of a sense of urgency to do to do a lot more.
And the last one: any single worst day.
There's been a lot of tough days, and going back to the point I made earlier, they're usually related to the violence that we've seen in the community. Mm-hmm. I think probably the most difficult thing is when we have young people that are victims of violence. I mean, thinking about towards the end of 2019, when we had the young boy that was shot, I visited kids in the hospital that have been victims of violence, and specifically gun violence, and it is heart-wrenching. So those are the thoughts that immediately come to mind. Mm. But thankfully, more good days than bad, and I hope and pray that that'll continue.
Well, again, thanks so much for making not only the time for the broadcast, but this time as well. Again, this was Syracuse City Mayor Ben Walsh, and Mayor Walsh, thanks again.
Thank you, Grant.
The Campbell Conversations was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Associate producers include Sarah Forland and Zane Aga. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit us online at wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations or download the show as a podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.